Well, a lot of stuff needs editorial curation. I mean, that's sort of what I'm learning on Reddit too. Like, I've been spending a lot of time on the Battlefield 3 Reddit, and I sent you an email about that. But the other thing I've noticed is there is good information, but a lot of it really, even though there's voting and stuff, it still gets buried because stuff falls off the front page really rapidly. They could be really good, and like there could be 15 comments, and there's this really good chunk of information, and comment 12, which is a reply to comment 3.
Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of, and the solution
it's
for a lot of
the
stuff
internet.
Is just, well, I know, but you need almost editorial, you need someone curating the stuff. Like, I don't know if
Creation.
There's a magical, I mean, we've tried to do it with our system, but man, it's a hard problem. Like, I think a lot of systems suffer from just burying information.
We have, now that we're actually saying useful things and that this might actually go out in the podcast, we should introduce our guest, who's Mark Rusinovic. Let me pronounce that correctly. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how's it going?
And Mark is known from, I guess, sysinternals.com, right? Is that a good way to put it? Which used to be NT Internals when I first found it. And it had, like all these bizarre command line utilities that would let you do things like kill a process running on a different Windows computer. I use that one all the time.
No better way to screw with someone.
And I swear to God, I read every line of the official Windows API documentation and could not figure out how that worked exactly, or how one would do that. How would one would even write such a program?
Yeah, and actually, there's no particular API for that. Before WMI, anyway, WMI introduced an API, but it used a technique where I actually injected executable onto the other system and had it proxy to kill.
So you would basically use the file sharing to put a little exe on there, and then you would
service
cause it
control
to,
manager.
And how would you run? Oh, you'd put a service on there, launch a service. Isn't that weird that like Windows had in the early days? It had all these utilities for services and daemons and stuff like that, but it didn't have basic utilities for like remote run a process on another machine. Like the more basic, they had the complicated features, but not the simple features.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that gave me a nice opportunity to go fill some holes.
how did you find that stuff? How did you figure it out?
Just reverse engineering and just looking at the problem. How do I kill a process on another machine? What tools are available? What APIs are available? And put them together in the right way to make it happen.
So were you actually, I mean, how did you even know what, I mean, the APIs were not documented. So are you like calling dump,
well,
running dump in and looking at what things
well,
are
the,
being imported?
The APIs, that command pskill, which is still a sysinternals tool it uses, are all documented.
Yeah. Oh,
there's,
okay.
Yeah, so it's an example of one of the tools that used all documented APIs. But for the undocumented ones, there's lots of tools that use undocumented APIs, Process Explorer being one of the most well-known. And that one, the way that I'd figure out the way a system worked internally was to use, back then, SoftDice, kernel debugger called SoftDice from New Mega Technologies, which I worked at briefly, and disassemblers. Custom disassemblers that I'd written, and then later on, IDA Pro.
Seriously? Wow. So you would basically disassemble Windows DLLs and look in there and see what the heck they were doing. And SoftDice was sort of a kernel debugger, but that's because it was actually, that thing originated as a hardware debugger, right? Like it lets you debug even when the CPU
it was called,
didn't want you to.
Actually, that one was purely
ICE,
which is kind of the play on the words. ICE is in-circuit emulator.
Oh, right, right. Yeah,
in circuit, whatever. I can't remember what the E stands for, but it was ICE was a hardware debugging system for debugging microcircuits, but SoftDice was a play on it.
And we needed
basically.
Just remember, like in 8086 era, you didn't have the idea of. I mean, you basically only had one ring of execution. You couldn't really get in below the operating system and debug.
Well, you didn't have the virtualization layer that you get now, but you did have the processor supported four rings. All OSs generally only use two of them, ring zero and ring three. And SoftDice and all the kernel stuff would run at ring zero. So SoftDice was basically, it was just a device driver. Mm. It would just take full control of the, take control away from the OS when it was active.
So Mark, piggybacking on that a little bit, you've become quite famous for a number of things. One is for being sort of a hardcore Microsoft hacker. Yes, they do exist, and Mark is actually an example of one. But the rootkit stuff, where you know, you were one of the first people to talk about the Sony rootkit in the Sony CD, the music CD, and the general problem of rootkits, which now is epidemic. Like, I think the malware stuff has gotten, some of it has gotten so good that it's my understanding that the secure boot stuff that Microsoft is doing in Windows 8 is kind of a reaction to some of the rootkits getting so good that they're almost unremovable without, like, a format like blowing the drive away from orbit.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, we are seeing this trend towards very highly, highly sophisticated malware. There's still tons of what I call junk malware out there, which is not, doesn't make a big effort to hide itself or infect deeply into the system, just because the goals that whoever's creating this kind of malware wants to accomplish are, they can accomplish them with the junk malware. Just, you don't have to be that sophisticated to do most of the things that these guys want to do. But for the cutting edge stuff where it's cyber espionage and cyber weapons like Stuxnet, that's where you're seeing the boundaries get pushed. Yeah. And actually even some of the more advanced botnet stuff you're seeing as well, some of that.
That was a good one. I remember that Sony one because they were basically putting rootkits on, was it a game or was it just like a music CD? I don't know.
It was their music CD.
Yeah, to prevent you from copying
DRM.
The music CD. Yeah. And what was funny is I had a friend who was working at Sony at the time, and he told me they wouldn't buy anybody Photoshop, so they were all using pirated copies of Photoshop at Sony because the company was too cheap to buy any software. Like, the whole company was operating on pirated software.
Well, look, remember, only their stuff is intellectual property worth protecting.
Exactly.
Everyone else's stuff, that should just be free.
I swear to God, that's the best argument for the corporate death penalty, if there were such a thing, where you'd just be like, that's it. Your corporation is not allowed to continue to exist. Goodbye. That's fun.
So, pretty beat up this year.
So, Mark, have you been involved at all in Windows 8 as far as, the technical...
Before you answer that, we should just say to our listeners who are confused is that Mark started outside of Microsoft, working on sort of figuring this stuff out from the outside, and probably you knew more about the NT internals than the average Windows programmer. But later, your company was acquired by Microsoft, and so now you work for Microsoft, right?
Right. And I worked on Windows when I joined Microsoft in 2006. I worked on the tail end of Vista and then Windows 7, beginning of Windows 8, the planning part of Windows 8. And then I left Windows a year and a half ago and joined the new operating system, the cloud operating system, Windows Azure.
And when you got there, you probably immediately said, I got to read this source code. Let's see what the hell is going on here. Did you have like a list of things you just positively had to read right away?
At Microsoft? Yeah. Well, actually, not really. I mean, I'd pretty much, found what I wanted to know through other methods. So it wasn't like this big, here's the source code. Wow, I'm going crazy with it.
Yeah.
It just made things easier. When I wanted to find out information at that point, it became a lot easier.
Right.
Well, usually it's a much higher level thing, but we use the MVC framework, and because it is open source, when usually we dip in when we're having specific problems, we're like, what the hell is this code doing? Like, why is this?
Yeah.
Like, usually at the point we have to read the code, it's bad. Like, it's like, wow, yeah. We don't really have this problem, and we need to figure out where it's coming from. So it's not like the first thing we reach for is to go read, MVC source code. So, Mark, getting back to the question, have you been involved heavily in Windows 8? It looks like there's a lot of really interesting changes in Windows 8, finally.
No, well, like I mentioned, I was in Windows during the Windows 8 planning process, but I've left Windows about a year and a half ago. So
you're on Azure, so.
Yeah, on Windows Azure. So I haven't really done much. I mean, I've got friends over in Windows still, and I keep tabs of what's going on there, but I haven't been working on that. I've been working on Windows Azure stuff.
And what types of things are you doing? Just scalability, or I mean, cause when I think
no,
cloud,
actually,
I think
the so the like a, we call Windows Azure a cloud operating system. It's an operating system for data centers, and it's got an application model. It's just like a desktop operating system has a model for how you describe an application to it. We've got an application as well, and the part of the Windows Azure group that I work on is called the Fabric Controller team. Fabric Controller is like the kernel in the cloud operating system. And just like the kernel in Windows, it manages the hardware in the data center. So the Fabric Controller is what's responsible for turning servers on and deploying hypervisors to them and starting virtual machines on them. And just like the kernel, it also defines what an app is or a process is. So the Fabric controller is what implements the compute network application model. So people write a Windows Azure application. That application is described in XML, and the Fabric controller consumes that XML and takes the code and the configuration and then launches the app and then monitors its health. So I'm doing things all up and down the stack, like working on low-level things, just like how do we get better performance out of our servers booting virtual machines, and running workloads like SQL Azure, which need more direct access to disks in our cloud environment, to figuring out how to incorporate other resource types into the application model. So today it's just compute and network, but we'll be integrating storage and Azure and messaging and other aspects, other cloud resources and middleware into the application model.
I see. So there's truly this concept of a higher level multi-server application. Because I know the main app we work on is obviously the website, Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange. And it's not abstracted to that degree, at least not the way we set it up. We have to code in the ability to write to sort of shared memory, if you will. We use Redis, which is basically a shared memory server. And we talk to that over the network. So presumably those kinds of things are built into Azure.
A lot of them are. We're still fleshing out the middleware services, but if you wanted to write a scalable website, you could do it in MVC. You could have you could use SQL Azure as a structured storage, or you could use Windows Azure Tables as no kind of unstructured storage, lightly structured storage. You could use queues for inter-machine communication, and when you create this website, it's follows a stateless model, so you can scale that out as much as you want, depending on what your load looks like, and it's load balanced by our load balancers automatically. The health is monitored automatically. If a machine fails underneath you, we'll reincarnate that particular virtual machine on a different server automatically. So there's a bunch of things that we'll also patch the operating system underneath for you.
So there's you stop having to worry about buying machines. You stop having to worry about dealing with configuration of the network. Pretty much you stop thinking about everything except for just upload your app and it just works. Is that the theory anyway?
Yeah. Yep, that's the theory. Yeah.
I think one of the things that programmers are often afraid of is that there's a level of abstraction that they don't control and can't monitor beneath them when they're on Azure or any of these other cloud computing things that run on VMs. So they may find suddenly that performance gets really slow for a few seconds because who knows, their VM is getting migrated or they don't even know what it's doing or the machine that it's on is heavily loaded or another VM on the same machine is doing something weird. And
well, we're taking efforts, and this is brand new area, so there's a lot of new developments we've got to do and questions we got to answer. One of them is trying to get performance to be as consistent as possible, which is something that we've consciously recognized now that customers don't like variable performance. They don't like, even if the peak is really great, if their troughs are there, it blows the whole experience. So we need to be consistent. We need to be good and need to be consistent so that people aren't in this what the hell's going on underneath me kind of situation.
Or they're sort of misattributing things. They think, oh, dear, have I done something wrong? And actually, they haven't. Yeah. They're just that's just the nature of the and I hear these complaints about AWS and Google App Engine all the time, which is like we don't even understand why this all of a sudden got slow.
Yeah. So we've got places in our system where you can see the noisy neighbor syndrome, and we're getting rid of them. So I think in the next 6 months to a year, our consistency story will improve dramatically, and hopefully be the best in the industry.
Cool.
So the one piece of advice we had, and we worked a tiny bit with Azure, and this was like a year ago, so this is real early in the life. Well, because I think Scott Hanselman had contacted us, and we were doing some stuff with OData, and we'd hosted some stuff there. And I recall the main beef we had was just it took so long between deployment
and
that really made us crazy. It wasn't so much the variable performance that didn't bother us. In fact, I think the performance was good. We had to build a fairly beefy server to even get what we were getting out of Azure.
Yeah, when we talk to customers, I'll hear, we love Azure, you know, people that are deployed on Azure. We love Azure, it's awesome, but deployment time. And so that's an area that we've got a big focus on right now. And we've made some improvements over the last few months. One of the things that we're going to get to, and this is, I think, a very realistic goal, is in sometime before the middle of next year to have deployment of a brand new virtual machine, Windows virtual machine, take 5 minutes or less, and an update of an existing virtual machine where you're updating the code in it to take 2 minutes or less. Today, those times are around eight or nine minutes for the 50th percentile for deployment, and 6 minutes for an update for the 50th percentile. So, this.
You mean between the time that you say I would like a new virtual machine and when you actually get it is 9 minutes?
For the 50th percentile, so right, the average is there.
Why don't you?
Tail that goes out to 13, 14 minutes.
Can't there just be a bunch of machines waiting around in case anybody needs one? Just pass.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of optimizations. It's more tricky than you would imagine.
I imagine so. I'm rather naive here, but it seems like there would be a line. Try calling Lands End Business Outfitters sometime. You'll see that they answer the phone even before it starts ringing because they know that they're going to get phone calls because that's what they do all day. They get phone calls.
Well,
so there's a person already holding the phone in their hand waiting.
Yep. I mean, certainly that is one idea that we might implement, which is the pre-allocation of virtual machines. There's a couple of issues with that. One of them is that that only handles part of the deployment time because we basically have the OS booted, but we can't have your code started in it. We can't have your code downloaded to it. So it shaves off some time, but at the same time, we've got to create virtual machines of the size that we expect and with the operating system release that we expect people to want. So it might be an optimization that only applies if you're using the latest and greatest release of an OS and you're want a certain size VM. But there's a lot more fundamental things that we're doing, from doing things like pre-allocating files to prefetching on Windows boot to doing kind of shortcuts on sysprep to inject things right into the virtual machine image. So there's a list of a dozen things that we're working on to improve the performance in different ways, just of the Windows boot process. And then there's a whole bunch of things around the system, from like your package gets uploaded to Windows Azure. And at that point, we start tearing it apart, optimizations on how we do that, how we get that down to the servers and so on. So lots of moving parts to go and optimize.
Sounds like a fun project.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. It's a ton of fun too, because this is all, like I said, it's new. So it's not like you can read somebody else's book and see how to do this.
That's true. When you're working on something that is only about three, I mean, that was always one of the great things about working at Microsoft. You know, you could work on an operating system where there are pretty much only about three operating systems of the scale of Windows under development at any given time. That have that scale and that level amount of deployment and that number of people using them. And
yeah, and I think that this is kind of the same opportunity as the way I view it. We're building a Windows, the Windows 3.0 or whatever you consider the big breakthrough version of Windows for the cloud. And there's not that many companies out there that can build cloud operating systems and really run them at the kind of at scale that proves them out. Where, you know, when a data center costs $150 million to build, not a lot of companies can go and investing in things like that.
Well, let me play devil's advocate a tiny bit. One of the things about Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange, we've gotten to be a pretty big website. What are we, Joel, and Quantcast, like top 200 now or something?
181. Well, yeah, not right. That so, I'm watching.
So, it doesn't really take that much hardware to run a pretty large web server. I mean, it serves a lot of people a lot of our pages are dynamic. We do serve, 90% anonymous users, in which case there's a lot of caching that goes on. But, these are pretty active websites. I mean, I'm not saying we're building, CNN.com or anything, but most people, it would be tough for them to get to this size, right? Like, you're not going to get to the size trivially. It's going to take a while. And for us, we were running on for a while, I think, four servers. Anyway, it's and right now we have maybe 10.
We're not even running on the world. Yeah.
That's sort of it doesn't take that many servers to run a giant, giant website.
No, but you forget, Jeff, that getting from 181 to like 150 is like four times as many page views.
Oh, sure.
I don't know if that's true. Sure. But somewhere in there, I heard that like Tumblr, for example, is just buying racks and racks and racks and racks and racks of servers.
Yeah, Facebook's running massive data. I mean, when you get to that kind of scale.
When you get to that scale, you're...
That's not the total focus of what we're doing either, is not just huge properties, you know, the internet kind of breakthrough Twitters of the world. But even guys like you, instead of buying your own servers, instead of managing the hardware, instead of managing your network, basically you can take your web app and within whatever today, 9 minutes, and have it up and running. Scale it out if your load does go up. I mean, one of the things about the cloud is that versus what you're doing is when you do grow, you've got to worry about, let me go buy a new server, let me go configure it, let me, and as you take on ownership of that and the networking configuration and the operating system configuration, the patching and maintenance of that, all that software, this is stuff that you don't have to worry about. Like you said, just take the app and deploy it and pay, and you're paying for what you use rather than these fixed costs that you've incurred.
That's especially important if you have, for some reason you have bursty traffic, or you can't predict in advance, or you're going to need a lot of extra servers for the Christmas rush or whatever it may be.
That's a great example of kind of cloud workloads, the bursty workloads, the periodic workloads, the workloads that, you know, we've got a bunch of different examples of workload patterns that do
better,
that are really do a lot better when you can just pay for what you need when you need it.
Yeah, it's weird with Stack Overflow. It's so remarkably predictable. I think we can just sort of look at the CPU load at a given time of day is pretty steady from day to day. I mean, it goes up every day, but you could sort of extrapolate from that pretty easily and figure out what hardware we're going to need.
Yeah.
No, I think that's all completely valid and makes sense. I was just pointing out there's a little bit of a weird disconnect between, you know, as computers get ridiculously powerful, and we're way beyond ridiculous now. It's absurdly powerful.
Yeah.
You can run, I mean, enormous websites off just one trivial little server, right? Because one little server, that's the disconnect. Like, you can build these massive server farms that are incredibly powerful, but you can also build a single machine that's also kind of crazy powerful.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's all valid, and it might, there's certain cases where it might make sense for you to manage your own servers and buy your own servers, but you do get a bunch of other benefits. I mean, we haven't even touched on, like, for example, disaster recovery. So your storage, if you're using Windows Azure Storage, we're replicating that across the country, so that if we do have a data center fail, even something that catastrophic, you're backed up. And like I mentioned earlier, with just the application model we've got, if a server fails, and we see 3-5% of our servers fail every year, mostly the biggest reason, disk failures.
Yep.
You're not impacted by it
for very long.
Well, I've definitely seen that. Well, first of all, I'm a world authority on backups, as Joel will attest to.
That's right.
No, I'm just kidding. No, we had some data loss, but it was actually a case where I kind of assumed, like, basically what you're describing, I assumed the server had some sort of RAID or some basic level of drive fail protection, and the server we had been given by the provider, who shall remain nameless for the purpose of this call, had no RAID, no nothing. It was just like a drive on a server.
Yeah.
So when the drive decided it didn't want to work anymore, it was like, well, hope you had backups, right? Like, we couldn't rely on them for what you're describing.
They were doing backups.
I certainly see the value of that.
But you were running in a VM, and your VM had its image file.
Oh, that's true. That's right. Yeah,
their
backup thing was really
They didn't pay
basic.
The extra $5 for the open file backup feature. That's probably
true.
An NT internals thing, too, right? there's that new API that they added to Windows with the volume shadowing or whatever it was called, which actually lets you take a gigantic file that stays open all the time, like an Outlook BSD or a database file, and actually back it up to a snapshot in time so that it would be consistent.
I don't know if you've seen my disk to VHD tool, but it's this internals tool that you can run on a physical machine, and it spits out a virtual image of it.
Cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your book. So one of the things I like about you, Mark, is that you write about very, very, very technical stuff on the Windows side, and yet it's really readable. Like, I feel like a person who didn't even know anything about Windows or even what you were talking about could, like, read it and sort of you are telling a story, you know, of mm-hmm. like, here's how I found this rootkit. The rootkit is an example. You were telling a story. It's like, well, I got the CD, I installed it, I noticed the strange thing about it, and then you sort of walked people through it. And you're a very good writer, which is what makes you a good technical communicator. It's why you're a technical fellow at Microsoft, all that good stuff. But it was just interesting that you decided to go all the way to writing a novel, which is sort of the ultimate end point there, where you're actually talking to people who, you know, are not hardcore, you know, computer geeks or anything. And that novel is, did you want to talk a little bit about your novel?
Zero Day.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I mean, you're referring to Zero Day, a novel that it came out in March of this year, and it's what I call a cyber thriller. It's about cyber terrorism and plot to bring down large chunks of the world we're using malware. And like you said, I tried to make it accessible to lay people, but yet be true to the science and make it so that somebody like me reading it would find it realistic and find enough technical detail there to be credible.
Or at least non-irritating.
I'm required by law to mention the computer-enhanced video that's on YouTube, the magical image enhancement that always happens in Hollywood and TV shows where you take some, you know, GIF that's like 6x6 pixel and you just enhance it. And all of a sudden, wow, you can see the reflection of his face in his glasses of a person standing across the street. So that kind of thing.
Yeah,
definitely.
Do image enhancement on it, yeah.
Yeah, just image enhance it and, you know, get infinite detail. It's like fractal. It's like my crazy fractal image. In fact, I just was checking on TechMeme and there was a news article about an attack against chemical compounds and various advanced materials in the military, like some sort of targeted attack. But the interesting thing about this, Mark, is these are all phishing attacks. They're not really the impression I get, and I actually read another book on this, and I need to look at the title, but this guy was talking about how pretty much all attacks these days are all phishing. It's basically trying to get somebody on the inside on the facility to click on a link, and usually it's problems in the web browser, like usually old copies of Internet Explorer or what have you. It's not really about direct attacks so much anymore. It's about the social engineering stuff. Yeah. I mean, is that your impression as well? Or
I think that's certainly there's a low barrier to entry. That's a very highly effective way of getting in, but I don't think it's limited to just that. I mean, if you look at some of the attacks that we've seen recently in the news in the last 6 months, a bunch of those have been taking advantage of vulnerabilities in websites or cracking passwords. And so I think it's a combination of all these things, which the thing is you cannot have a weakness anywhere because somebody's going to find it.
Yeah.
But spear phishing is what the kind of attack that you're talking about. I think, so I've written a sequel to Zero Day. It's called Trojan Horse. The editor is currently reading the draft right now, so I'm waiting for their feedback before for my next edit pass. It's going to be published early next fall, and it's focused on state-sponsored cyber espionage, which almost exclusively is based on spear phishing. And the spear phishings can be really, really sophisticated. And the basic scenario around spear phishing is you work at some agency that somebody wants to penetrate, and you might not even be the person that they want to get to, but you work near them or in the same network, and you get an email from somebody that looks like you knew or somebody that you potentially could have met.
Kind of a generic
and
name.
A classic example, and you can go find real cases of this posted where the actual emails and documents that associated with the stuff have been posted, where it'll say, it was great meeting you at that conference last week. Here's a document on the subject that we discussed. And it's an infected PDF file or Word file that you open it up and you're owned. And that's taking advantage of two things, right? One is the vulnerability in the document viewer. And the other one is the spearfish at the same time.
And the social engineering of having it look like it comes from.
Yeah.
And those things that, I mean, I've seen, you know, viruses that have access to your address book will actually send you an email that did actually come from somebody that you actually know.
Yeah. and that's another, that's the way that you could also do this too. It's like once you infect somebody at that company, then you send email from their email account.
Right.
To somebody else and infect them.
Hey, Mark, should we put virus detection software on our servers?
Yes, absolutely. You don't have it on your servers.
All right, Jeff, there you go. Decision has been taken.
Well, we have a lot of performance problems, and we're worried that, you know, the overhead's going to be kind of extreme. We're kind of trying to isolate to servers where there's actually a server where they upload, like for careers, you actually upload Word documents containing your, you know, your CV or your resume, trying to really limit it to there. Because, you know, on Linux, if you say, I want to install antivirus, you sort of get laughed out of the room. So we're trying to limit it to where people actually upload stuff to servers because performance is so critical for us.
I mean, security is all about risk management, and I think one of the problems is that it's really hard to measure the risk anymore. You never know if you guys are going to end up on the front page of TechMeme for having been your website being taken over, or whether antivirus is really going to help you stop that.
Right. I guess it sort of depends a little bit on the value of the thing that is being protected, so to speak. So
that's my
true too.
It depends on the service.
It's kind of worthless.
And exactly, is it my bank account or is it, you know, your Stack Exchange account? I mean, it wouldn't really be that.
I mean, I think everybody you should be going through the exercise. What if our server got infected? How do we respond to that? And what are the implications of it?
Absolutely, that makes sense.
We close down. That's it. I give up. no Stack Overflow. Hopefully, y'all have the Creative Commons data dump. Somebody else can set it up, and we give up.
Yeah, well, so much of what we do is public. Like, part of the reason we started the company, Mark, is that transparency, basically. Like, even the stuff we do internally, like with the discussion we're having about antivirus on the server, you'll get different answers about it. But just having the conversation in public, publicizing the results, and thinking about the process behind that, like, should it be a knee-jerk? Like, see, I hate knee-jerk stuff. That really rubs me really raw. Like, oh, you must do X. That immediately makes me not want to do X. Like, I want to think about, like, why would you do X? Like, what are the actual reasons you would do X? So, like you said, think about the consequences. Like, what, you know, what's the cost? You know, measuring the cost, measuring the effect, just walking through some of the models and seeing what the consequences actually are for that.
I mean, the thing is, too, with antivirus, it shuts down a certain vector. But the spear phishing attacks we've been talking about, antivirus isn't any good for, because these things are custom malware. Doesn't show up on any of our signatures.
Yeah,
it's just stuck
in fact,
circulating for a year.
Looking at a screenshot, which is one of the emails that was sent to these chemical facilities in the U.S., Bangladesh, and the U.K., and it's like a fake Adobe Acrobat update where they're trying to get you to upload, execute an attachment to the email, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're really subject to the security model of the machine that's running the executable at that point, and it's live on the network as that user, right?
Yeah.
If they actually execute it.
Okay, now I'm totally scared.
Well, yeah, some of it is definitely scary. I mean, I think really the scariest is that you know you're always as vulnerable as your weakest employee.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you're least technically comp.
On the night that they log on drunk.
Well, your weakest employee, your weakest configuration, or your weakest software. That's really all of it.
Right.
Depending also on how much somebody's targeting you versus just sort of randomly spraying around the world. You know,
well, that's right. Like, who cares? Like, I mean, I don't know. For Stack Exchange, going back to how much of our stuff is public, like, almost everything on your user profile, like if you have a Stack Overflow, Stack Exchange user profile, a lot of that information is public. We don't publicize, like, your real name, your email, but it's not like these are state secrets, you know? And the purpose of participating on the network, now, not on the career side, it's a little different because you're giving us, we don't store credit card information. That's another big plus in the, you know, keeping stuff secure is like we don't even store it. There's no way to get to credit card information. So you're actually buying a product from us on the career side. But on the Stack Exchange side, everything you do is supposed to be public. That's the whole point. Like, that's why you're there. We don't have private messaging. We don't. Everything should be in public to be of value. That's one of my core values.
No, but somebody might say, hey, we got a lot of clever programmers on Stack Overflow. I'm going to put a download onto Stack Overflow and tell everybody to download it and run it.
Well, yeah.
Are you running the live stream off of your GONE servers?
No. That's just a machine that sits here in the office and talks directly to the live stream server.
Okay. So the login is theirs, not yours.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Wait, do we have a... Alex! Do we have a vulnerability you're about to tell us about?
It looks like it's probably their login.
Wait, when you say login, you mean?
Well, there's a... It, on the live stream page.
Oh, there's a login
button. There's a login button,
yes,
at the
that's
top.
That's theirs. Correct. Yeah. And that wouldn't do anything for you, really.
Yeah. Well, the thing is with those, this is how people crack other crack passwords on other accounts.
Yep.
Right. Is I harvest these passwords. I sell them. Somebody else goes and looks at them, finds some juicy name that they correlate to you, and you happen to be using the same password on your Twitter account and your Facebook account and your bank account.
Yep. Yep. That is sort of an issue. There's a lot of stuff that is spreading way more slowly than I think it should. I'm very happy about Gmail now having two-factor authentication. So you basically, without my iPhone, you can't log on as me from any other machine that's not my
Everybody listening
computer.
To this, that is so important, Joel. I want everybody listening to this to turn on two-factor auth, because you have
Gmail.
No idea.
Yeah.
Your email is a skeleton key, literally, for like everything you do.
Go to any website in the world and say, I forgot my password.
Yeah, exactly. Forgot my password. All they have to do is guess that you use a particular website, do a password recovery, and then if they control your email, you're owned. You're beyond owned.
Yeah.
And there's this horror story in The Atlantic. I'll dig up the link for you, Alex, for the show notes. But
James Fallows wrote that.
About basically once your email gets compromised, you're super screwed. Like, go turn on two-factor auth right now. And I'll be honest with you, it's a pain in the ass. Like, it really is a pain in the ass, because I use like I probably use 10 different computers, to be honest with you, on a ongoing rotating basis. And like every time I touch one, I have to then get the text code for it.
Yeah.
So it's a pain, but the cost of somebody controlling my email is they could take over my life, literally.
Right. There's also
turn it on.
Definitely turn on the two-factor authentication. Totally worth it. The other thing is that I think the banks are starting to get a little bit better about requiring higher levels of security confirmation if you're coming from a different machine. So my bank, for example, will not let me log on to another machine until it calls me and gives me a a number to type in, and it'll call me at one of the three phone numbers that I've told it about.
So what bank is that?
What's that?
What bank is that?
No, I can't tell you that.
I'm using a major, huge, major multinational bank, and it
are you social engineering, Joel?
I think it's JPMorgan Chase, and they do. Now, it's interesting because that reminds me sort of an old social engineering technique, which is you find out the outbound phone number that they're using. Ooh, we have John Sheehan right there. You find out the outbound phone number that they're using to make that phone call to tell you what the number is, and you call that number right when you think they're about to call out.
Yeah.
This is like an old technique from the days of modems.
Yeah, Kevin Mitnick uses that technique in his book, Ghosts in the Wires. Speaking of hacking books, that's a great book.
Right. So in other words, the attacker calls the person who's getting attacked right at the time when the person who's getting attacked thinks they're calling somebody. And they think the phone call has gone through, but they've actually just picked up the phone.
Yeah.
And they're now talking to the wrong person, and they think that they have made a call when they've actually received a call.
Whoa. Really?
Get
is
it?
That a thing?
Yeah, that worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, people.
Wow.
Somebody hacked a Swiss bank with that technique.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, like I said, go read Ghosts in the Wires. Kevin used that technique at one point.
Fairly.
Kevin Mitnick used that?
In the day.
Really?
Probably with modems, right? Where you can control the timing and the modem doesn't really know what it's hearing, so it just dials happily.
Yeah.
Even when it's picked up the phone.
Mm. Yep.
You can. Sometimes you have to broadcast a fake dial tone. Right, so you call the guy up real quick, broadcast, you transmit the sound that sounds like a dial tone, so he starts dialing, and then you pretend to be ringing, and then you pretend to be answering, and ta-da.
I've kind of given up on requiring people to use smart passwords. Like, I just don't think that works for human beings. Like, I don't think the average person is really going to do a good job of picking passwords.
Oh, not for every site.
You also don't need it for something like Stack Overflow. There's so few accounts where you need really hardcore security. It's your banks and your email, basically.
I don't know.
Would you agree with that? Where would you pick really strong passwords?
What about website that you use to order diapers from once a month? Diapers.com.
It's an important one.
And plus, you never know when it's like the Gawker. Who are those people? I don't want to blame Gawker if it's not Gawker. But one of those blog sites that suddenly
Gawker got hacked and their entire password database got decoded.
Yeah, and like half of those passwords probably work on Gmail.
Yeah. And half of those passwords were password.
I would separate my passwords into tiers. The passwords
that's one way to do it,
What would you put in the highest tier? Like, what types of sites would you put in the highest tier? Like, worry a lot about
the ones
these
that I do e-commerce at. And I actually, the ideal thing that I'd do is do payments through something like PayPal or one-time credit card payments.
Where that's even a good point. Well, that's like the so the OpenID thing that well OpenID slash it's really okay. The credential system we're trying to promote, or at least I personally am trying to promote, is this idea that you log in using third-party credentials, period. It doesn't matter if it's OpenID, it doesn't matter if it's OAuth 2.0, which is what Facebook uses. The point is you use some other form of credentials where the people running the credential are not morons, basically.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, like that, PayPal, that's the way I think we need to go, too. Yeah.
Yes. So that's basically what you're doing. When you say, hey, Jeff, you know, I like to use PayPal for this reason, that's the same reason, Joel, that we use this concept of third-party authentication, because you can pick – now, you could pick, you know, Joe's shack of logins, right? In which case, hey,
or
you made a bad
OpenID or something.
And to be honest, like, it has hurt, because some of the OpenID providers, the lesser ones, have just stopped. They just gave up. Like, they just don't. They don't care anymore. Like, they don't work or whatever. So you can put your trust. That's the downside of this approach, Mark. You can put your trust in PayPal, which presumably is here, presumably knows what they're doing, presumably will be around. Or you can put your trust in, you know, Joe's shack of online payments, in which case you get boned, right? Like, they were storing your password clear text. All your information is revealed. But I feel like unless we build systems like that, we're setting ourselves up for a huge failure later with this idea of everybody has 100 different passwords. Everybody has, you know, credit card information stored on 100 different sites.
We are slowly converging towards that because of this explosion of web services where every web service you go to log in with a new password. Although you see them now starting to standardize on other credential providers,
Google,
like
Facebook,
Twitter.
That's it's sort of funny because I sort of think that one thing this does show is that there are not that many malevolent people in the world, because there would be way more stories about identity attacks, and I think this stuff would be way more common if there were just more malevolent people, because it's just not so easy.
Well, I think security,
the percentages are actually pretty high.
Pretty content, really.
Yeah, actually, Facebook just came out and said that 600,000 Facebook accounts are actually compromised last week. They reported that.
Wow. Jeez.
I want to look up this. So the book I read, Mark, I don't know if you've read this, is Kingpin. How One Hacker. I can't read the rest of the title because it's something in my Kindle app. But I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good book. I really enjoyed it. I recommend it. Also, your book as well, to put a book in front of your book. But that's the one I've actually that I had read months and months ago, way before this call. And it was interesting because he really delineated two periods of time, sort of the year 2000 period, like the first boom. Security was apparently really bad, because he was walking all over systems. Like, I think Linux was very new. Windows was much more vulnerable. And he kind of did time. He got caught for some stuff, and he came out, and he said after he came out, security was like a whole new world. Like, everything really got better, and that's why they started turning more to the phishing attacks, because these direct attacks were just not working as well anymore. Security substantially got better, at least from this guy's perspective. And, you know, he was at least some kind of hacker.
The security got better, but you've seen a leap in sophistication of attacks as well, and spread of attacking knowledge in the last few years too. So I don't think it's like we passed some threshold on the security side of things, and now it's just all phishing attacks. You know, Stuxnet is a great example.
Yeah.
But wait, how does Stuxnet gets on through phishing?
That's a super sophisticated attack, right?
Well, Stuxnet, assuming they get one key infected. And they were also spreading through the network using printer vulnerability in a printer. You know, the print spooler that was patched, but yet lots of people hadn't patched. I mean, this is the case where security has improved, but almost all the attacks recently have been through misconfiguration or unpatched software.
Yeah.
But these systems were, I'm looking on Wikipedia for Stuxnet. It targets Siemens industrial software and equipment running Windows. Presumably it's running a very old version of Windows. See, this is kind of what I'm getting at. I'm assuming...
No, actually, it worked on Windows 7 as well.
Really? Wow. Okay, yeah. So it's better than I thought. So it wasn't like just old industrial equipment running XP. That's always what I assume when I hear that.
One of the zero
stuff.
Days that it exploited is Windows zero day on Windows Vista, because they wanted to make sure it could spread on newer operating systems as well.
Wow. Interesting. Well, that's the other reason why, you know, and we had discussions about Vista, and, you know, Vista was a disappointing release on a lot of fronts, but it did get security a lot more right than XP, but probably because it's, you know, 8 years older. And that's one reason why I really wanted people to upgrade, was just to get a more secure basis for their operating system. And I'm really encouraged by this secure boot stuff I'm hearing about in Windows 8, although there's been some resistance to it because there's some feeling that, oh, it's secure boot, you're trying to prevent us from loading Linux on our machines. But the real motivation for
that's,
it is
that's
to prevent...
just a benefit. That's just a side
also,
effect.
As I recall, though, Stuxnet used a 0 day to get inside, didn't it?
That's what
it actually
said.
They used 4 0 days. Yeah. Several of them were used to elevate privilege on the local box, and then it used this patched vulnerability in the sprint and the principler to spread remotely. But it used another 0 day to infect machines through Explorer off the USB key.
So, ooh, it also used stolen keys. Wow. Jeez, this is hardcore.
It's really sophisticated. So,
oh,
Mark,
it used 4 0-day attacks. Wow.
Yeah.
So, Mark,
this is crazy.
Who do you think wrote it?
I think the predominant theory is that it's U.S.
You'll
and
say
Iran and Israel.
Yeah, I would just say, I know that's kind of become the consensus. It's like, it's way too sophisticated to
it's
not
obviously
be state-sponsored.
The Mossad.
I mean, the thing is, I think that I don't think the U.S. was fully responsible for it, because I don't see the U.S. government condoning the theft of these certificates and using them to sign.
Really? That's the reason? The CIA, have you read anything about what the CIA does?
Look, we're fine with brutally murdering people and overthrowing their governments, but we will not steal digitally signed certificates.
Yeah, apparently,
I actually do think that they draw the line on that one.
Apparently, the live feed is rough, but I don't know what we can do about that, Arthi, since we don't really control that. This is an example of a system that's not under our control, Mark.
That's right. We're very paranoid.
We're like,
about
wow, this
not
is happening
through
the cloud, so guess what? You're all screwed because we have no control over what's happening.
Yeah.
That is the downside of that. And I think, too, going back to a little bit of the cloud stuff, it's nice to go to your customers, whether you have, you know, people that are paying you money or just hardcore users of your site, and say, this is our fault. We're going to fix this. Versus, oh, well, EC2 is doing the best they can, man. You know?
Yeah.
And talking about sort of your strategy of how you use EC2 and how you use Azure, or maybe you use both Azure and EC2,
well,
right?
My philosophy has always been that you take whatever level you think is the right level of abstraction to buy. And then if it's for your one, in other words, the right level of abstraction for Stack Exchange using janitorial services is not to do it ourselves. So we just buy janitorial services and we buy catering services because we can't do the best job. But then you take the one thing that is your mission critical. This is your business. This is the heart of your business. And you go one level too low in abstraction, right? Like you provide the abstraction yourself. So the perfect level for Stack Exchange might be to use Azure. But since that's at the heart of what we do is operate those websites, we go one level lower and actually control the machines. And someone else in a different position, like the Azure team, probably does not buy off-the-shelf servers, because their business is probably providing service features on those servers. They probably customize them heavily or you know, pay a lot of attention to exactly the hardware config of those servers. So wherever you're adding your value as a business, you use something that's like a little bit too manual so that you have like that absolute maximum control over the thing that controls your ability to make money or not.
Well, I agree to that to an extent, but I think that when it comes to the cloud, part of the problem is that the cloud is so new that it's not proven. And I think that when it comes to running your mission critical business, you need
more
to
proven.
have a track record that you can rely on. You can look back and say, how reliable has this service been? How consistent has it been? And if it meets your quality threshold, then you're willing to buy into it. We're too young to have that kind of trust.
Yeah, but there's somebody for whom hosting of applications in the cloud is not their core business. I mean, maybe they're a concert promoter and they have a website that lets you buy tickets once in a while. And for them to just outsource that whole thing is fine, because that's not, it's really the concert promotion is the most important thing of what they're doing.
But even if it was, I think that, you know, our businesses are all dependent on the internet connection that we're using.
Right.
The phone lines that we use to make phone calls.
I don't know. If the internet connection to the Stack Exchange office goes down right now, it's not the end of the world. So we just use whatever provider is in the building and, you know, reasonably reliable. On the other hand, if the internet connection to Pier 1 goes down, then we're in trouble. So we're very careful about how that is provisioned. In other words, the things that are the things that are how we make our money and how we make our profit and how we, our core business, we want an extra level of control. We want one level, you know, we don't want the abstraction that provides the perfect thing.
My point was, is that the internet connectivity that we've all built our businesses on has gotten good enough to the point where we can build our businesses on it.
Yeah.
That we're not creating private networks to connect to our customers.
Yeah. I mean, another aspect of that is people don't realize just how much they get out of these services that are doing about 10 levels more than they would be able to do. So, I'm trying to think of an example. Just thinking about the level of, like, there are these companies that provide DNS services and companies that provide hosting. What are some other? I'm trying to think of some other examples where they're just doing. Oh, I know what. Mail delivery, right? So email delivery, transactional email. Is the kind of thing that everybody was like, I don't get it. There's a control. I have a custom control called send mail, and I just use it to send mail. What's the big issue there? And then you discover that there are all these companies that are basically offering to offer something, which is the command line of sending mail. But what they're really doing is they have a whole team of people that knows how to get things through spam filters and knows how to talk to the postmasters at the large email providers to make sure that your transactional email is not seen as spam by mistake, and knows how to deliver, you know, 18 billion messages in 1 second and all that kind of stuff. So you actually actually do get a lot of benefit from outsourcing it to somebody that specializes in that thing.
Yeah. I mean, the same thing with security, too.
Kind of random.
It's just one of the examples. To tie back to what we were talking about earlier, is that we're going to spend a lot more money and energy on security than most people can, than you guys are going to, probably.
Right.
Yes, totally. And I mean, that's totally another thing that I was very pleased with about Vista and Windows 7 was that Windows XP was developed in a completely different era. I mean, nobody had, you know, pervasive connectivity. There weren't, you know, people trying to attack you all the time. And, you know, Windows Vista, despite all the problems it had, definitely had a much more hardened security model with UAC and stuff like that. And I think with Windows 7 and Windows 8, hopefully they'll go further in that direction, because everybody's machine needs to be really, really secure out of the box. You know, that's the world we live in now. And the only way to fix that is really for the people who are shipping the most code to the most consumers to have hardened, you know, operating systems, basically. So, Mark, what was the reaction to your book in terms of, like, you know, what were you seeing? I mean, what was your goal? Was your goal merely to entertain, or was it to educate, or a little bit of both? Or
yeah, it was definitely both. I mean, that's why I put the technical stuff in there, was so that it was somewhat educational. Somebody picking up the book could get an idea of what cybersecurity is about, what being a practitioner in the field of cybersecurity entails, and learn really. I 100% believe that the scenario I paint in the book is a very realistic scenario. I'm actually surprised it hasn't happened. I mean, every week there's some headline that just blows my mind at how ridiculous it is, like the Predator drones being infected with malware that being announced a few weeks ago. Stuff that is stranger. It's like and actually what's crazy is that in Trojan Horse, I got these fake news bulletins in starting various sections in the book. One of the news bulletins for Trojan Horse, which I'd finished the draft of a couple months ago, was Predator drones getting infected with.
So these things are flying over Western Pakistan and stealing credit card numbers of the tribes in Waziristan,
yeah, <exactly. laughs>
transmitting them back to Russia, where they're being used to buy access to pornography websites. It's shocking.
It's a beautiful thing, Joel. Technology.
we are almost out of time. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a fun conversation.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Mark Rusinovich at Twitter, Mark Rusinovich at Facebook, and ZeroDayTheBook.com.
Cool. We will have links to all those things in the show notes, which we put up on blog.stackexchange.com. It comes out tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern.
And before you go, Mark, again, thank you. I'm a huge fan, and I love all your work. Are you planning another book after this one, or what's the next
thing? Well, like I said, I finished Trojan Horse, so that'll be out next fall. And then,
oh, awesome.
We'll see what happens after that.
Okay, cool.
I was waiting to see how kind of Zero Day did before I really pushed hard to finish Trojan Horse, which I've been working on for a couple of years, and the response to Zero Day has been great. The publisher said they wanted another book, so here it comes.
Excellent. So keep an eye out for that.
Cool. We will buy some copies for the office.
Awesome.
Well, I'm already scared, Joel.
Yeah, I'd be glad actually to send you a signed copy or a few if you want to give them away, too, as part of...
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yeah, that'd let's do awesome. That. Let's have some... Alex, producer and, Alex, we'll make it so.
Oh, and you know, we forgot to plug our own sites. We do have a security site, Mark.
Oh, yeah, itsecurity.stackexchange.com.
Yeah, security. And we also have a site for writers as well. We always forget to plug our own stuff, Joel. It's just security.stackexchange.com, Joel.
Oh, okay, it redirected.
But the quality has been pretty high there, actually. I'd be curious to see, Mark, what you think of what we're doing there, if you have time.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a pretty active site, actually.
But yeah, writers turned out to be mostly about sort of fiction writing. And that surprised me a little. So, but right up the alley for anyone writing a book, for sure. That's your site.
Cool. Well, you have been listening to Stack Exchange Podcast 25. Did I get the number right over there?
Yes, you did.
I never
get it. Congratulations. Yay. Also, I want Punyon to be our janitor. You were talking about we don't outsource our janitoring because we...
No, we do. We do. That's the whole point, is that we outsource our janitoring.
Yeah. By janitoring, he means they come pick up the trash, nothing else.
That's really pretty much it, right? They might vacuum once a
year.
No,
they don't vacuum.
No.
We need Punyon to do that.
If yeah. Really? They don't vacuum?
Really?
See? Punyon.
How do we live here? No wonder they don't allow dogs in the office. It would rapidly be covered with fur and snow. And all right. That's it. We'll see you next week. Oh, next week, special guest, Chris Mootpool, or Pool, or Chris Pool, or Moot, from 4chan and Canvas, who will talk to us. He has a website that is completely unmoderated, in which anybody can and does say just about anything that they want, and they post things. And almost everybody on that site is anonymous, including Anonymous, the non-anonymous anonymous people.
That'll be a good one. We've had some really...
Yeah. So we'll have a lot to talk to Chris about, and that'll be next week. See you next week.
All right.
Yeah, see you next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.